This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. If you had the chance to travel into space, would you do it? Space tourism is on the horizon, but space travel is fraught with risk. Here are just a few of the dangers. The flammability of all that fuel that's needed to blast off from the surface of the Earth. The space shuttle holds 500,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. Once you're in space, you've got to steer around space debris. You're exposed to a significant amount of radiation, and more than half of those who travel into space experience motion sickness. Our guest this afternoon is Neil Cummins. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine, and he's the author of A Tourist's Guide to Space, The Hazards of Space Travel. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Neil Cummins. I look forward to hearing from you. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Neil Cummins has worked at NASA's Ames Research Center, developing computer models of the galaxies, including our Milky Way. He is the author of 10 books, including What If the Moon Didn't Exist? And Heavenly Errors. His new book, The Hazards of Space Travel, A Tourist's Guide, is published by Villard, an imprint of Random House. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Cummins, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
If you had the opportunity, would you travel into space?
Yes, but it's not at the top of my list.
Yeah.
I would probably be interested in going for orbits around the Earth or to the Moon for a few days, since I now know what I'd be facing.
Yeah.
But a longer trip than that, I have serious reservations about doing it myself.
Yeah, and some of these longer trips, if you think about how long it would take to go to a planet, say Jupiter, It's a number of years you're talking about. That's a long time.
Absolutely. Jupiter's moons are probably the Everest of space travel in the next 100 years or so. Even to Mars, is the round trip is going to be in excess of 6 months.
Yeah.
So it's a serious investment of time and parts of your life.
Yeah. Now, a few tourists, very wealthy tourists, have traveled into space, and Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic has been planning to launch tourists into space they're planning to do this within a year or two. And there's a fellow who's spending hundreds of millions of dollars to develop the first commercial space station. There's some other things underway in the planning stages and beyond planning. Do you think these ventures are viable?
I think the short answer is yes. The long answer is things are going to happen on the way, and they're going to be very expensive problems. The people who are developing and the people who are going have to realize and accept those risks. There was a huge explosion recently at the site where they're developing the Dick Rutan designed spacecraft, for example. There are going to be setbacks, but in principle, yes, I think they are doable in the next decade or so with people going into space as tourists on a larger scale than they are today. I think actually that's probably one of the very few good reasons to develop space travel.
Hmm. You know, a question inherent in The Hazards of Space Travel, your book, is, you know, what if something goes wrong? And the book includes fictional log entries from an experienced space tourist by the name of Mac Richardson. And this character has been traveling in space since he was in his teens. And I found myself thinking, among other things, when you start to think about what would be involved to get people in space as tourists, you know, given the risks, do we allow kids to journey into space? And what's the upper limit on age? What kind of legal and regulatory systems are we going to see develop?
Interesting questions. The short answer for children for longer than a few days or a few weeks, maybe, in orbit around Earth is no. And they really, really, really should not go. And the reason they shouldn't go is that their bodies are still growing, developing, changing, and in ways that space can really, really, really mess up. For example, children's bones are often going through spurts of development.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you get into space, I mean, we're talking, you know, within minutes of getting into space, your bones start losing calcium. So in the process of growing, if you're losing the material that you need to grow, until those things are well understood, and it's going to take decades or centuries or a century to know that, until those things are well understood, children should not travel in space.
Mm.
On the other end is interesting. John Glenn went back up into space and did quite well. I don't know that there is yet an established reason not to allow senior citizens to go into space if they can pass the same or a set of medical and psychological tests that are given in the normal course of sending people into space.
Yeah. What about this question of, you know, regulation? And I know this is outside of your purview as a, you know, in astronomy and in physics, but, you know, I think it's an interesting question about, you know, for example, you know, is the FAA at work on regulations for space tourism?
I honestly don't know if the FAA is working on it. My gut feeling is that it's going to have to be done internationally.
Mm.
For example, right now we don't send tourists in our spacecraft, but the Russians do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. That they've opted for that. The people know the dangers involved, and they're willing to take those chances. And they pay the Russians for it, and that process has worked so far. When something goes wrong, then I think that, you know, they're going to have to start rethinking it. But the Chinese are getting ready to, well, have gone into space, and other countries are going in that direction. So I think that it's going to have to be international. And what agency, perhaps under the UN or elsewhere, will make those decisions on the rules that you're asking about, I think that really remains to be seen.
Yeah. How soon might it be before we could sign up for a trip, say, to the moon?
The moon is probably not that far away. Something like this, 10, 12 years, is sort of a ballpark. If in the best of all possible worlds, NASA and the other agencies and countries who are planning to go back to the moon are able to do so, then probably within a half a dozen trips there, when they've got the system of shuttle, you know, spacecraft to go between the Earth and Moon established and the landing procedures well understood, I suspect that tourism will start.
Yeah. Now, what kind of training will be required for someone planning a trip to the moon?
Quite substantial, actually. It's a combination of both physical and mental training. The physical training, it turns out, as soon as you get into space, your muscles and your heart and your circulation all start changing, and there is no way to absolutely stop those changes that we know of. So the physical, you know, part of the process is going to be getting in good shape. Of course, going through extensive medical tests to make sure that you don't have problems that could occur, you know, when you're in space, incipient heart condition, for example, something that hasn't happened yet, but there might be indicators. Those kinds of tests you'll have to pass. But if you do, then you'll be training to be as in good physical shape as possible. But you'll also go through extensive training on the psychological aspects of it. For example, the spacecraft are not large facilities. Many, many people inside them, as in submarines, feel cramped.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real problem if that grows to claustrophobia. Because then you have a problem and the people with you have a problem. If you are claustrophobic, if an episode occurs and you feel that you absolutely, positively have to get out of there, you can't.
Yeah.
So that kind of training, and there are ways to desensitize people, is going to have to take place. Learning to work as a group, as a team, is going to be very important. You'll probably spend months, especially if you're going to the moon, months and months, working with the people you're going with, getting to know them, getting to trust them, getting to understand their strengths and weaknesses, so that when you do go and things do go wrong, and they will, you'll be able to work together rather than sort of come apart at the seams. So that kind of psychological training is really important. Knowing what some of the very standard things you're going to face in space, such as if you're going for, let's just pick a number, say 3 weeks to the moon, the trip is going to be broken up into parts emotionally. And there is going to be a period in the middle or towards the third quarter, well, actually called the third quarter syndrome, where you're going to start feeling very down, very, unaffected, and even possibly depressed. Those kinds of feelings often occur on long trips here on Earth. People who are in submarines, people who stay in Antarctica for long times, go through this third quarter syndrome of feeling blah, and you will in space if you're up there for a long time. And knowing about it and working with the team psychologist is going to help. So you have to go through that kind of training too.
Mm. It might be a little bit like a roller coaster ride.
In some ways, it's really going to be. I mean, the blast off is going to be a high acceleration experience. And the travel there is going to be, weightless experience. And returning to Earth is going to be another very high acceleration. And those are only the physical things. The psychological roller coaster is going to, as I was alluding to earlier, is going to be much more dramatic.
Yeah. Well, now that we have some astronauts out there currently aboard the Endeavor, and it hasn't been decided yet, but they might be called on to repair that gouge in the underside of the shuttle. Will space tourists be called on to do similar work? Will someone traveling into space need to know, if you will, how to change a tire?
That's so important. The short answer is yes. And what they found in space and in other isolated environments is that if the people there are doing and feel like they're doing important work, contributing to the mission, it makes a huge difference in their feelings about the trip and their teammates and so on. So people who are going to the moon or to Mars or to an asteroid, whatever, are going to be trained to do real important fundamental things for the good of the trip. So that their contribution makes them feel good and also helps. So the short answer to your question is definitely yes.
So in addition to the training, you might also need to undergo training to do repair and maintenance and
absolutely
other kinds of things.
Yes, things that you may well not have ever had any experience doing or any expectation to do in your life. But when you're part of a team and the responsibilities have to be broken up, chances are extremely good you will be given something to learn how to do that can be essential, even if it's something like operating the hatches, making sure that they're sealed, making sure that there are no air leaks, things like that. Really important part of the job, and everybody on those trips, tourists and otherwise, are going to be involved.
Mm. Space tourism is our topic this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest is Neil Cummins. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine, and he is the author of The Hazards of Space Travel. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions. Comments are also invited. Here are the numbers if you'd like to join us. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free. 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener in Terre Haute, Indiana. Line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is about the fact that the space station has been occupied continuously for, I don't know, years now. And doesn't take much imagination to realize that the odor in there must be horrendous. And what do they do for the new guys coming in on the space shuttle to desensitize them or something? They'd have to do something and get them ready for opening that hatch.
The history of odors in space has gone on long enough that, to the best of what I've been told and my understanding, now on spacecraft like the International Space Station, they filter the air well enough that the people are fairly comfortable coming into it. That was not, believe me, you're absolutely right, it was not always the case, and it was sometimes just profoundly problematic. But they do a lot of filtering today with the air systems, charcoal filters and electrostatic filters, to get out most of the odors. In fact, odors now, it's kind of interesting, odors now have gotten to the point that they are warning indicators that something's wrong. There was not too long ago, 6 months ago perhaps, a problem on the space station that caused odors to be created, told the astronauts that there was something wrong. They sealed off a part of the station until they could figure out what it was and fix it. So that problem is diminished and as I say, has been turned around to benefit the people up there, because when they smell the odors, they can now know something's wrong and respond appropriately.
Hmm. Oh, very interesting program. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the question. How do they handle bugs? And by that I mean, bacteria and viruses. How do they keep things clean?
Well, that's a huge issue. Several of the space stations, the Mir space station, the Soviet Mir state, had such problems with infestations of mold and mildew and the smells they generated that they essentially had to leave it. Abandon the place. Now they use the disinfectants. They work very hard to keep surfaces clean, and whenever there are signs of mold, mildew, and other bugs growing, they get right down to work on it. Ultraviolet radiation that can be used is used to filter the air, kill the bugs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really important problem. Been around long enough, they are actively working to prevent it from becoming the problem it used to be.
Yeah. How do they handle the problem within spacesuits? You can't send them out.
No, you can't send them out to the cleaner. Fortunately, they don't use them long enough. Although they get incredibly sweaty. And the moisture is filtered out so that the air and the environment in the spacesuit doesn't have the problems. And when mold and mildew do become a problem, they can disinfect them. Mm. But it used to be a real issue. When the first astronauts and cosmonauts did extravehicular work outside the spacecraft, they would lose pints of water, become very, very dehydrated, and that water was in mm-hmm. their spacesuits.
Sure.
And when it wasn't taken out, if it wasn't taken out and they were up for a long time, it did become a problem.
Let's take another call. A listener in Spring Bay, line one. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm skeptical, and I'm skeptical of the future of humans in space for a bunch of different reasons. First of all, we're broke as a country. We're in debt. The debt seems to be getting larger and larger. We're facing global climate change. Our bridges are starting to fall apart. We're going to have more and more energy crises, I think, going into the future. And I just see all of these earthbound problems starting to become a problem with politically, how do we continue to justify the expense of sending humans into space? I could certainly see sending scientific instruments, which would dramatically cut down the cost and the weight and all of that. But I just think that we've about reached our limit in terms of humans in space. And I'll hang up and listen off on the air. Thank
you. Okay.
The caller had a very important and mm-hmm. and accurate concern, and I share it. I don't think that we can invest in human space travel in the very near future. That is. At the scale that some people would like, and expect that everyone is going to return safely from long voyages and in good health, and to make it worthwhile. There are, however, the good news is that there are, however, reasons why human space travel should or could be developed in the near future, and I'll give you two of them. One is tourism, which is, of course, what we're talking about. In other words, if people are willing to pay for the experience, then and if they know what the risks are, which is what this book was written for, then there would be financial justification to go because, essentially, as I say, they would be paying for it. The other short-term possibility is that when we send spacecraft spacecraft without humans to discover what things there are on the moon, on nearby asteroids, things that we could mine, things that we could use for manufacturing, things that might help us avoid having to damage the Earth any more than we have, and mine those things from the moon, from asteroids, even manufacture in space, bring those goods or ores back, use them here, then it could become depending on what's out there, it could become a very money-making operation, and that would require, at least in part of it, it would require people to go out there and do it. The exploration could be done by robots, and I definitely believe that's how it should be done. But in the end, people are going to have to be involved in space in money-making operations, and the caller's concerns about these issues that we have on Earth and our not being able to afford it as a country now, entirely justified, I think, could be overcome by making space exploration by humans, money-making operations.
Yeah. Centuries ago, we set off in sailing ships to explore the globe. Are there things that we can learn by looking back at that experience and applying it to what lies ahead?
Yes, I really think so. However, if we add to the historical exploration, the fact that we now have a level of technology which is really impressive, I think that we can do that kind of exploration you were just describing much, much more effectively, much less expensively by sending robot spacecraft to do the exploration. We're doing it on Mars now. It's unbelievable what information scientists and the human race has gained about Mars from spacecraft where no people have had to go. And because people haven't had to go, the spacecraft are much less expensive. We can send more of them, look at more places around Mars, for example, and get the information that required people on wooden sailing ships hundreds and hundreds of years ago to acquire.
Yeah. You know, one of the questions that came to me as I was thinking about the idea of space tourism and the, you know, the ticket price is, you know, given that even if you were to blast off with Richard Branson and spend 2-3 hours up above the Earth, and you fork over $100,000, $200,000, you know, for me, the question, you know, is a tourist, is that something ethically I could do, to spend that kind of money for 2 or 3 hours worth of, albeit a heck of a ride?
For me, I don't think I could justify it.
Yeah.
However, there are lots of wealthy people there are lots of people on Earth, and enough of them are wealthy, and enough of those wealthy people would find that experience an attractive part of their, you know, their lives. That I think that people will do it, and he will make money once the operation, you know, once the bugs are out of the system. So I think that because there are so many different people in the world, and some of them in position to take those trips, that even though most of us would say, I can't afford it, you know, if I spent that money on that trip, I would lose too much other opportunity. That I think that he will find enough people to say, yes, I really need that.
Yeah. Well, hopefully those folks will also be making a gift to their favorite public radio station as well, right?
Absolutely.
Let's take another call. Listener in Terre Haute, line 4. Another caller in Terre Haute. Hi. Hello? Line 4? Nope. Well, let me invite other listeners to join us this afternoon in this conversation about space tourism. Our guest, Neil Cummins. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine, the author of The Hazards of Space Travel, A Tourist's Guide. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Tell us a little bit more about Mac Richardson and what his experience has been in space. He's this fictional character that you've created to help us pull us into the science of what space travel is all about.
Yes, Mac is an interesting character. I have not written non-fiction. Excuse me. I have not written fiction novels, if you will. And so he was the first character I've ever tried to create, and I started actually much earlier in his life than is in the book, and I wrote lots and lots of things about him and his parents to try to explore what it might well be like this century, the 21st century, with people going into space and having to deal with all the kinds of issues that space travelers are going to have to deal with. So he actually helped me see the big picture of all the kinds of physical, medical, psychological, social issues that space travel is going to include. And so as I wrote about him, I thought of new things to write about in the science, and then the science helped me generate new thoughts about him. It was a feedback. He was very helpful.
Yeah, interesting. I wonder if this is a technique you'll use with your students.
It That's an excellent question. I'm still, working through how to do that.
Uh-huh.
I wrote that book you mentioned, What If the Moon Didn't Exist, years ago, and asking what if questions.
Uh-huh.
I have incorporated, and they are extremely effective in teaching.
Hmm.
So Mac, I hope to be able to incorporate him in the next few years.
Hmm. Let's take some more calls. Next, we're going to go to Effingham, line 4. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting show. I have just a comment, a quick question I'll ring off. I agree with Celeste's comment about the ethical point of view as far as being $200,000 or $300,000 for a trip. But there's an awful lot of people that take what I would consider extravagant vacations or extravagant vehicles or extravagant homes. And, I think you could probably apply the same rationale to their lot.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, I think kind of tourism in the vehicles we have now, your guest mentioned, I think Russia's already doing that, but extended tourism days, months and...
Well, we're...
It would have to completely redeveloped from what we're currently doing, sources of energy and spacecraft. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank
you. Okay. You're breaking up a little bit. I guess if we're having these kind of problems on Earth... We can imagine vehicles and fuel and that kind of thing. Are we going to have to see some research and development things going on here to make this practical?
Yes, we are definitely not to the point where we can comfortably expect, for example, to send people to Mars, expect them to land safely, have a rocket waiting for them to blast off because their rocket is going to take a huge beating going into that atmosphere and come back again. So developing the rockets, the vehicles, if you like, the fuels, to reliably go to distant places beyond the moon and carry humans safely, that really is a work in progress.
Let's take another call. A listener, let's try now for Terre Haute. Line 3, hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
When I was a youngster, there was a cartoon in the newspaper called Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. And I remember my physics teacher poo-pooing the idea that this would never happen. Now, I'm 85 years old, so you know how long ago that's been. But now we're talking about people going off into space. And my question is this. Will it be as common someday for a youngster to come to his dad and say, Dad, can I take the rocket ship and go to a party in Mars, rather than saying, Dad, can I take the car to go to a party Saturday night?
That's a great question. The short answer is not Mars. The long answer is the moon, sure. It's interesting. There are ways of getting to the outer world, Mars and asteroids and so on, with gravity or the effect of gravity in your spaceship. Because it's the lack of gravity, the weightlessness, that caused problems for children, for all travelers, but for children it would be disastrous. When they can create the equivalent of gravity in spacecraft, it will be safer for younger people to go. However, there are still many too many problems for anyone going to Mars, anyone as a child, going to Mars for at least the next century, I think. However, if you want to go to the moon and you have the money and the time, we're talking like a week or two. I think that even children can go to their parents someday and ask for that ticket.
Very interesting. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line 1. Hi.
Hi. I had a question about the ethical implications of space tourism. It just seems like it uses a tremendous amount of resources just using the state-sponsored space exploration. And isn't it kind of a waste of thousands of gallons of rocket fuel just to send a couple of people up into space?
The short answer, again, for this specific question is yes, it is a huge usage of resource. Most of those resources, happily, are renewable. The hydrogen and oxygen that are used to go into space, literally form water vapor as they come out the rocket engines. And it's expensive, but the water vapor or other chemicals can be broken back up into hydrogen and oxygen and used as fuel again. So in that sense, the space process, the process of going into space, isn't as completely against the idea of saving our environment. Some of the fuels, however, are a real problem. So I think that we can make a case that it's okay to go into space if somebody's going to pay for it, not us, and the resources will be mostly renewable.
Okay, I thought that they used fossil fuels, but so is the technology for space tourism drastically different than the regular technology?
Good question. Yes, it is. Most of the fuel that puts the space shuttle into space is literally hydrogen and oxygen. The fossil fuels are not used for the main rocket engines. So yes, if that's your concern, it's not an issue.
Okay, thanks.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. Next, we're going to take another call in Urbana. Line 2, hello.
Hello. Hey, I hate to be a wet blanket, but there's a plague going on in the earth, namely AIDS. I wonder how you reconcile that with space. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
The whole issue of medical problems, both here on Earth and in space, very interesting, because what often happens for the benefit of people on Earth is that when a country puts a lot of money into something in space, we get good things back. Just as a simple example, the CCD cameras that we use today, and which give us magnificent photographs, that was originally done by developed by American spy agencies, put in spacecraft, look down on the Earth, and get images, and other things too, but that's the basic. And when they had better versions of the CCDs, they declassified them and let us astronomers first and then the rest of the world use their technology. Turns out that going into space as far as medicine is concerned, to your question about AIDS, people have discovered in space there are large numbers of medical problems, and they have to be overcome. They have to be understood. They have to be overcome. A simple example is that as soon as you get into space, your body starts changing shape, which is to say that your legs shrink, your face swells up, your brain starts getting more blood than it needs, and you have to adjust. And when they learned that, they started finding things, medicines and other things that would help the people in space. It also helps people back on Earth. They discovered when they went into space that medicine in space changes. In other words, aspirin is not as good in space as it is here on Earth. They had to figure out, and they're still working on this, they had to figure out what happens to the medicines, what happened to the people in space, how to help those people in space when the medicines aren't working, and apply that back on Earth. Same with dentistry, by the way. Sealing teeth and so on is also a space-related concept. So the point is, with AIDS and with other major diseases, as we go into space, with all the huge number of medical problems that it creates going into space, it is very likely that the benefits for medicine here on Earth will soon come back from space and help us here.
How rapidly is the field of space medicine growing?
That's interesting. I don't know the numbers of people, but we're talking hundreds, if not thousands, of physicians involved in space medicine now. conferences, big conferences on space medicine occur when people share both the knowledge they have from the astronauts and cosmonauts, but also they send experiments up into space to see what happens to living creatures, low-level type things, worms and so on, as their first step to understanding what's going to happen to people for long term. And even those experiments they do now often have, if you'd like, trickle-down effect to help us on Earth.
Yeah. You know, where people travel, people take their problems. And there was an article a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times about trash in space, space junk. And this is a problem that one could see growing by leaps and bounds. Are there plans for dealing with this kind of debris as we put more people and more stuff into space?
People are thinking about it hard. Let me give you an idea what how serious the problem is. As of last year, there were over 600,000 pieces of space debris in orbit around the Earth where the space station and the shuttle orbit, bigger than about a half an inch across. And it doesn't even take that size, size of an eraser on a pencil can destroy a spacecraft if it's going fast enough. So for actually decades, the military has had radar to track larger pieces the size of a pencil. They can account for many of their locations. The best they can do now to answer your question, however, is to warn the spacecraft, the space shuttle, for example, that they're getting near something. And if it's convenient to have the shuttle actually steer around it. Nevertheless, the impacts continue to occur. Something like one out of every seven space shuttle windows has to be replaced after each trip because of impacts. So finding a way to sort of vacuum space out hasn't been developed yet to the best of my knowledge. That issue is becoming important enough that in the next 50 years or so, something will have to be done.
Yeah. One last question here, because we're out of time, but you know, this goes back, I guess, to space medicine, and you know, we're not expecting to run into any Martians on Mars. On the other hand, there might be stuff on the planet that is alien to us in terms of, you know, what would happen if we brought it back with us. And, you know, I'm talking about microscopic kinds of stuff, you know, back to that idea of, you know, bacteria, viruses, bugs, something there. And I remember as a little kid when after the first moon landing, when the astronauts came back, they took a good deal of care with them in terms of cleaning them up and isolating the moon rocks and that kind of thing. Is that an issue as we journey out to other planets?
Absolutely, positively, yes. We don't know if there's life in Mars, I should say, because life needs liquid water, and there's almost certainly liquid water in Mars. If there is, and if life has evolved, good bet that it has, then your concerns are extremely well-founded, which is why NASA and other space agencies are sending spacecraft to Mars to look for signs of life on the surface and even, you know, a few meters down to see, you know, if they find something, then they'll have a heads-up on how to protect people who go. But in any event, the plan, they are going to have to be extremely careful. Because if there is life there, its infective abilities, its ability to infect people here is probably huge. The same thing happened when people went from one continent to another centuries ago, by the way. Same exact kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, and recent studies have shown, unfortunately, that the isolation for the people who went to the moon wasn't good enough. If there really had been live bacteria, viruses, and things, they would have been able to actually get out of the isolation.
Really interesting stuff. Neil Cummins, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure.
Neil Cummins is a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine. He's the author of The Hazards of Space Travel, A Tourist's Guide.